event, not just what immediately grabs our attention. We imagine, as best we can, the negative consequences of the various strategies we are contemplating. We consider how the problem or the apparent opportunity might play itself out over time, how other problems or issues not apparent in the moment might suddenly loom larger than what we are immediately dealing with. We focus on our long-term goals and realign our priorities in the present according to them. In other words, this process involves distance from the present, a deeper look at the source of problems, a wider perspective on the overall context of the situation, and a look further into the future, including the consequences of our actions and our own long-term priorities. As we go through this process, certain options and explanations will begin to seem more logical and realistic than others that grabbed us in the moment. We add to this the lessons we have learned over the years about our own patterns of behavior. In this way, though we cannot recreate the full effect that time has on our thinking, we can approximate it. Most often, the passing months give us even more information and reveal better options for us to have taken. We are manufacturing this effect in the present by widening what we consider and opening our minds. We are moving up the mountain. Such an elevated perspective can calm us down and make it easier for us to maintain our presence of mind as events unfold. Although this stands as an ideal, we must admit that such a perspective is rare among us humans. It seems to require an effort that is almost beyond us. The reason for this is simple. Short-term thinking is hardwired into our system. We are built to respond to what is immediate and to seek out instant gratification. For our early human ancestors, it paid to notice what was potentially dangerous in the environment or what offered an opportunity for food. The human brain, as it evolved, was designed not to examine the full picture and context of an event, but to home in on the most dramatic features. This worked well in a relatively simple environment and amid the simple social organization of the tribe, but it is not suited to the complex world we now live in. It makes us take notice mostly of what stimulates our senses and emotions and miss much of the larger picture. This has a decided impact on how we view the potential pleasure or pain involved in a situation. Our brains are designed to make us notice what could immediately harm us in our surroundings, but not to pay great attention to other dangers looming in the future that are more abstract. This is why we tend to give much more attention to something like terrorism, immediate pain, which certainly deserves our scrutiny, than to global warming, distant pain, which in fact represents the greater danger since it puts the very survival of the planet at risk. But such a danger seems abstract in the present. By the time it becomes not abstract at all, it might be too late. We tend also to grab for things that offer immediate pleasure, even if we know about the negative long-term consequences. That is why people continue to smoke, drink, do drugs, or engage in any self-destructive behavior in which the destruction is not immediate and dramatic. In a world that is complex, with myriad dangers that loom in the future, our short-term tendencies pose a continual threat to our well-being. And as our attention spans decrease because of technology, the threat is even greater. In many ways, we are defined by our relationship to time. When we simply react to what we see and hear, when we swing from excitement and exuberance to fear and panic at each new piece of dramatic news, when we gear our actions toward gaining as much pleasure as possible in the moment without a thought for future consequences, we can say that we are giving in to our animal nature, to what is most primitive and potentially destructive in our neurological makeup. When we strive to go against this grain, to consider more deeply the consequences of what we do and the nature of our long-term priorities, we are straining to realize our true human potential as the thinking animal. And just as short-term thinking can be contagious, one individual who embodies the wisdom of the far-sighted perspective can have an immensely positive effect on the people around him or her. Such individuals make us aware of the larger picture and reveal a mindset that we recognize as superior. We want to imitate them. Throughout history, there have been various icons of this wisdom to inspire and guide us. Joseph in the Old Testament, who could see into the hearts of men and foresee the future. Socrates of ancient Greece, who taught us how to be less foolish and more consequential in our thinking. The brilliant strategist Zhuge Liang of ancient China, who could predict every movement of the enemy. Leaders such as Queen Elizabeth I and Abraham Lincoln, renowned for the success of their long-term strategizing. The very patient and prescient scientist Charles Darwin, who finally exposed the effects of deep time on the evolution of all living things. And Warren Buffett, the most successful investor in history, whose power is based on his far-sighted perspective. If possible, avoid deep contact with those whose time frame is narrow, who are in continual react mode, and strive to associate with those with an expanded awareness of time. Four signs of short-sightedness and strategies to overcome them. Most of us imagine that we engage in some form of long-term thinking. After all, we have goals and plans. But really, we are fooling ourselves. We can see this most clearly when we talk to other people about their plans and strategies for the near and more distant future. We're often struck by their vagueness and the lack of deep thinking people generally give to such plans. They are more like hopes and wishes, and in the rush of immediate events, feeling pressure and the need to respond, such weak goals and plans are easily overwhelmed. Most of the time, we are improvising and reacting to events with insufficient information. Basically, we are in denial about this because it is hard to have perspective about our own decision-making process. The best way to overcome this is to recognize the clear signs of short-sighted thinking in our own lives. As with most elements of human nature, awareness is the key. Only by seeing these signs can we combat them. The following are the four most common manifestations of short-term thinking. 1. Unintended consequences. History is littered with endless examples of this phenomenon. In ancient Rome, a group of men loyal to the Republic feared that Julius Caesar was going to make his dictatorship permanent and establish a monarchy. In 44 BC, they decided to assassinate him, thereby restoring the Republic. In the ensuing chaos and power vacuum, Caesar's great-nephew Octavius quickly rose to the top, assumed power, and permanently ended the Republic by establishing a de facto monarchy. After Caesar's death, it came out that he had never intended to create a monarchical system. The conspirators brought about precisely what they had tried to stop. In 19th century India, under British colonial rule, authorities decided there were too many venomous cobras in the streets of Delhi, making life uncomfortable for the British residents and their families. To solve this, they offered a reward for every dead cobra residents would bring in. Soon, enterprising locals began to breed cobras in order to make a living from the bounty. The government caught on to this and canceled the program. The breeders, resentful of the rulers and angered by their actions, decided to release their cobras back on the streets, thereby tripling the population from before the government program. Other notorious examples would include the 18th Amendment, establishing prohibition in the United States in 1920, which was designed to stop the spread of alcoholism, but only ended up increasing alcohol consumption by a substantial amount. And the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese in 1941, designed to decimate the U.S. naval force in one blow and bring America to its knees. Instead, it shook the American public out of its deep isolationism, ensuring the total mobilization of the country's superior manpower and resources to not only defeat the Japanese, but also to obliterate its military for good. The very success of the attack guaranteed the opposite of the intended result. We can find less dramatic examples of this in our daily lives. We try to control a rebellious teenager by putting some restrictions on his behavior, only to make him even more rebellious and uncontrollable. We try to cheer up a depressed person by making her realize that her life is not that bad, and that the sun is shining, only to find out we have made her even more depressed. She now feels guilty about her feelings, worthless, and more alone in her unhappiness. A wife tries to get her partner to open up more to her. With the hope of establishing more intimacy, she asks him what he is thinking, what happened during the course of the day, and so on. He interprets this as intrusiveness and closes up further, which makes the wife more suspicious and more prying, which closes him up even further. The source of this age-old syndrome is relatively simple. Alarmed by something in the present, we grab for a solution without thinking deeply about the context, the roots of the problem, the possible unintended consequences that might ensue. Because we mostly react instead of think, our actions are based on insufficient information. Caesar was not planning to start a monarchy. The poor people of Delhi despised their colonial rulers and would not take kindly to suddenly losing money. Americans would be willing to go to war if attacked. When we operate with such a skewed perspective, it results in all kinds of perverse effects. In all of these cases, a simple move partway up the mountain would have made clear the possible negative consequences so obvious to us in hindsight. For example, offering a reward for dead cobras would naturally cause impoverished residents to breed them. Invariably, in these cases, people's thinking is remarkably simple and lazy. Kill Caesar and the Republic returns. Action A leads to result B. A variation on this, one that is quite common in the modern world, is to believe that if people have good intentions, good things should be the result. If a politician is honest and means well, he or she will bring about the desired results. In fact, good intentions often lead to what are known as cobra effects, because people with the noblest intentions are often blinded by feelings of self-righteousness and do not consider the complex and often malevolent motivations of others. Non-consequential thinking is a veritable plague in the world today that is only growing worse with the speed and ease of access to information, which gives people the illusion that they are informed and have thought deeply about things. Look at self-destructive wars such as the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the attempt to shut down the American government for short-term political gain, the increasing number of financial bubbles from tech stocks to real estate. Related to this is a gradual disconnect from history itself, as people tend to view present events as if they were isolated in time. Understand. Any phenomenon in the world is by nature complex. The people you deal with are equally complex. Any action sets off a limitless chain of reactions. It is never so simple as A leads to B. B will lead to C, to D, and beyond. Other actors will be pulled into the drama, and it is hard to predict their motivations and responses. You cannot possibly map out these chains or get a complete handle on consequences. But by making your thinking more consequential, you can at least become aware of the more obvious negative consequences that could ensue. And this often spells the difference between success and disaster. You want depth of thinking, to go to several degrees in imagining the permutations as far as your mind can go. Often going through this process will convince you of the wisdom of doing nothing, of waiting. Who knows what would have resulted in history if the conspirators had thought this out and chosen to wait until Caesar died naturally or in battle? While this mode of thinking is important for individuals, it can be even more crucial for large organizations, where there's a lot at stake for many people. In any group or team, put at least one person in charge of gaming out all of the possible consequences of a strategy or line of action, preferably someone with a skeptical and prudent frame of mind. You can never go too far in this process, and the time and money spent will be well rewarded as you avoid potential catastrophes and develop more solid plans. 2. Tactical hell. You find yourself embroiled in several struggles or battles. You seem to get nowhere, but you feel like you have invested so much time and energy already that it would be a tremendous waste to give up. You have actually lost sight of your long-term goals, what you're really fighting for. Instead, it has become a question of asserting your ego and proving you are right. Often we see this dynamic in marital spats. It is no longer about repairing the relationship, but about imposing one's point of view. At times, caught in these battles, you feel defensive and petty, your spirit drawn downward. This is almost a sure sign that you have descended into tactical hell. Our minds are designed for strategic thinking, calculating several moves in advance toward our goals. In tactical hell, you can never raise your perspective high enough to think in that manner. You are constantly reacting to the moves of this or that person, embroiled in their dramas and emotions, going around in circles. The only solution is to back out temporarily or permanently from these battles, particularly if they are occurring on several fronts. You need some detachment and perspective. Get your ego to calm down. Remind yourself that winning an argument or proving your point really gets you nowhere in the long run. Win through your actions, not your words. Start to think again about your long-term goals. Create a ladder of values and priorities in your life, reminding yourself of what really matters to you. If you determine that a particular battle is in fact important, with a greater sense of detachment, you can now plot a more strategic response. More often than not, you will realize that certain battles are not worth it in the end. They're a waste of valuable energy and time, which should be high on your scale of values. It is always better to walk away from a circular battle, no matter how deeply you feel personally invested in it. Your energy and your spirit are important considerations. Feeling petty and frustrated can have reverberating consequences for your ability to think strategically and reach your goals. Going through the process delineated previously in the keys will naturally elevate your perspective and put your mind on the strategic plane. And in life, as in warfare, strategists will always prevail over tacticians. 3. Ticker tape fever. During the run-up to the 1929 crash on Wall Street, many people had become addicted to playing the stock market, and this addiction had a physical component. The sound of the ticker tape that electronically registered each change in a stock's price. Hearing that clicking noise indicated something was happening. Somebody was trading and making a fortune. Many felt drawn to the sound itself, which felt like the heartbeat of Wall Street. We no longer have the ticker tape. Instead, many of us have become addicted to the minute-by-minute news cycle, to what's trending, to the Twitter feed, which is often accompanied by a ping that has its own narcotic effects. We feel like we are connected to the very flow of life itself, to events as they change in real time, and to other people who are following the same instant reports. This need to know instantly has a built-in momentum. Once we expect to have some bit of news quickly, we can never go back to the slower pace of just a year ago. In fact, we feel the need for more information more quickly. Such impatience tends to spill over into other aspects of life, driving, reading a book, following a film. Our attention span decreases, as well as our tolerance for any obstacles in our path. We can all recognize signs of this nervous impatience in our own lives, but what we don't recognize is the distorting effect it has on our thinking. The trends of the moment in business or politics are embedded in larger trends that play out over the course of weeks and months. Such larger spans of time tend to reveal the relative weaknesses and strengths of an investment, a strategic idea, a sports team, or a political candidate, which are often the opposite of what we see in the micro trends of the moment. In isolation, a poll or stock price do not tell us much about these strengths and weaknesses. They give us the deceptive impression that what is revealed in the present will only become more pronounced with time. It is normal to want to keep up with the latest news, but to base any kind of decision on these snapshots of the moment is to run the risk of misreading the larger picture. Furthermore, people tend to react and overreact to any negative or positive change in the present, and it becomes doubly hard to resist getting caught up in their panic or exuberance. Look at what Abraham Lincoln had to face in a much less technological age. At the outbreak of the Civil War, he looked at the larger picture. As he estimated it, the North should prevail because it had more men and more resources to draw on. The only danger was time. Lincoln would need time for the Union Army to develop itself as a fighting force. He also needed time to find the right generals who would prosecute the war as he desired. But if too much time passed and there were no big victories, public opinion might turn against the effort, and once the North became divided within itself, Lincoln's job would become impossible. He needed patience, but also victories on the battlefield. In the first year of the war, the North suffered a great defeat at Bull Run, and suddenly almost everyone questioned the president's competency. Now even level-headed Northerners such as the famous editor Horace Greeley urged the president to negotiate peace. Others urged him to throw everything the North had into an immediate blow to crush the South, even though the army was not ready for this. On and on this went, the pressure continually mounting as the North failed to deliver a single solid victory, until finally General Ulysses S. Grant finished off the siege at Vicksburg in 1863, followed soon by the victory at Gettysburg under General George Meade. Now, suddenly Lincoln was hailed as a genius. But some 6 months later, as Grant got bogged down in his pursuit of the Confederate Army under General Robert E. Lee and the casualties mounted, the sense of panic returned. Once again, Greeley urged negotiation with the South. Lincoln's re-election that year seemed doomed. He had become immensely unpopular. The war was taking too long. Feeling the weight of all this, in late August of 1864, Lincoln finally drafted a letter spelling out the terms of peace he would offer the South. But that very night he felt ashamed for losing his resolve and hid the letter in a drawer. The tide had to turn, he felt, and the South would be crushed. Only a week later, General William Tecumseh Sherman marched into Atlanta, and all the doubts about Lincoln suddenly vanished for good. Through long-term thinking, Lincoln had correctly gauged the relative strengths and weaknesses of the two sides and how the war would eventually trend. Everyone else got caught up in the day-by-day reports of the progress of the war. Some wanted to negotiate, others to suddenly speed up the effort, but all of this was based on momentary swings of fortune. A weaker man would have given in to such pressures, and the war would have ended very differently. The writer Harriet Beecher Stowe, who visited Lincoln in 1864, later wrote of him, "Surrounded by all sorts of conflicting claims, by traitors, by half-hearted, timid men, by border states men and free states men, by radical abolitionists and conservatives, he has listened to all, weighed the words of all, waited, observed, yielded now here and now there, but in the main kept one inflexible, honest purpose, and drawn the national ship through." Lincoln provides the model for us all, and the antidote to the fever. First and foremost, we must develop patience, which is like a muscle that requires training and repetition to make it strong. Lincoln was a supremely patient man. When we face any kind of problem or obstacle, we must follow his example and make an effort to slow things down and step back. Wait a day or two before taking action. Second, when faced with issues that are important, we must have a clear sense of our long-term goals and how to attain them. Part of this involves assessing the relative strengths and weaknesses of the parties involved. Such clarity will allow us to withstand the constant emotional overreactions of those around us. Finally, it is important to have faith that time will eventually prove us right and to maintain our resolve. 4. Lost in Trivia. You feel overwhelmed by the complexity of your work. You feel the need to be on top of all the details and global trends so you can control things better. But you are drowning in information. It is hard to see the proverbial forest for the trees. This is a sure sign that you have lost a sense of your priorities. Which facts are more important? What problems or details require more attention? The icon for this syndrome would have to be King Philip II of Spain, 1527 to 1598. He had a prodigious appetite for paperwork and for keeping on top of all facets of the Spanish government. This gave him a feeling of being in control. But in fact, in the end, it made him lose control. He fussed over the placement of toilets in his new palace at Escorial and their precise distance from the kitchen. He spent days deliberating on how exactly particular members of the clergy should be addressed and remunerated. But sometimes he would fail to pay proper attention to important reports on spies and national security issues. Poring over endless reports on the state of the Turkish army, he believed it showed signs of great weakness and decided to launch a war against the Turks. Somehow he had misjudged. The war would last 18 years, have no definitive resolution, and bleed Spain of money. A similar process occurred in relation to England. The king had to read every single report on the state of the English navy, the support of the people for Queen Elizabeth, every minute detail about the country's finances and shoreline defenses. Based on years of such study, in 1588 he decided to launch his armada against England, feeling certain that, having made the armada large enough, Spain would prevail. But he failed to pay enough attention to weather reports, the most critical factor of all. For storms at sea would spell the destruction of the armada. He also failed to realize that by the time he had compiled and assimilated enough information on the Turks or on England, the situation had actually changed. So while he seemed extremely detail-oriented, he was never quite on top of anything. Over the years, Philip strained his mind with so much reading that he had frequent headaches and dizzy spells. His thinking was definitely impaired, and he made decisions that ended up leading directly to the irreversible decline of the Spanish Empire. In some ways, you are probably more like King Philip II than you would like to imagine. In your life, you are more than likely paying attention to some details that seem immediately important to you, while ignoring the weather reports that will doom your project. Like Philip, you tend to take in information without considering your priorities, what really matters in the end. But the brain has its limits. Assimilating too much information leads to mental fatigue, confusion, and feelings of helplessness. Everything begins to seem equally important: the placement of toilets and a possible war with the Turks. What you need is a mental filtering system based on a scale of priorities and your long-term goals. Knowing what you want to accomplish in the end will help you weed out the essential from the non-essential. You do not have to know all the details. Sometimes you need to delegate. Let your subordinates handle the information gathering. Remember that greater control over events will come from realistic assessments of the situation. Precisely what is made most difficult by a brain submerged in trivia. The far-sighted human. Most of us live within a relatively narrow time frame. We generally associate the passage of time with something negative, aging and moving closer to death. Instinctively, we recoil from thinking too deeply about the future and the past, for this reminds us of the passage of time. In relation to the future, we may try to think about our plans a year or two from now, but our thinking is more like a daydream, a wish, than deep analysis. In relation to the past, we may have a few fond or painful memories from childhood and later years, but in general, the past baffles us. We change so much with each passing year that who we were 5, 10, 20 years ago might seem like a stranger to us. We don't really have a cohesive sense of who we are. a feeling of connection between the 5-year-old and 35-year-old versions of ourselves. Not wanting to go too far in either direction, we mostly live within the present. We react to what we see and hear and to what others are reacting to. We live for immediate pleasures to distract us from the passage of time and make us feel more alive. But we pay a price for all this. Repressing the thought of death and aging creates a continual underlying anxiety. We are not coming to terms with reality. Continually reacting to events in the present puts us on a roller coaster ride. Up and down we go with each change in fortune. This can only add to our anxiety, as life seems to pass so quickly in the immediate rush of events. Your task as a student of human nature and someone aspiring to reach the greater potential of the human animal is to widen your relationship to time as much as possible and slow it down. This means you do not see the passage of time as an enemy, but rather as a great ally. Each stage in life has its advantages. Those of youth are most obvious, but with age comes greater perspective. Aging does not frighten you. Death is equally your friend. It motivates you to make the most of each moment. It gives you a sense of urgency. Time is your great teacher and master. This affects you deeply in the present. Awareness that a year from now this current problem you are experiencing will hardly seem so important will help you lower your anxiety and adjust your priorities. Knowing that time will reveal the weaknesses of your plans, you become more careful and deliberative with them. In relation to the future, you think deeply about your long-term goals. They are not vague dreams, but concrete objectives, and you have mapped out a path to reach them. In relation to the past, you feel a deep sense of connection to your childhood. Yes, you are constantly changing, but these changes are on the surface and create the illusion of real change. In fact, your character was set in your earliest years, along with your inclinations towards certain activities, your likes and dislikes. As you get older, this character only becomes more apparent. Feeling organically connected to who you were in the past gives you a strong sense of identity. You know what you like and dislike. You know who you are. This will help you maintain your self-love, which is so critical in resisting the descent into deep narcissism and in helping you to develop empathy. Also, you will pay greater attention to the mistakes and lessons of the past, which those who are locked in the present tend to repress. Like everyone, you enjoy the present and its passing pleasures. You are not a monk. You connect to the trends of the moment and to the current flow of life. But you derive even greater pleasure from reaching your long-term goals and overcoming adversity. This expanded relationship to time will have a definite effect on you. It will make you calmer, more realistic, more in tune with the things that matter. It will also make you a superior strategist in life, able to resist people's inevitable overreactions to what is happening in the present and to see further into the future, a potential power that we humans have only begun to tap into. The years teach much, which the days never know. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Chapter 7. Soften people's resistance by confirming their self-opinion. The law of defensiveness. Life is harsh and people competitive. We naturally must look after our own interests. We also want to feel that we are independent, doing our own bidding. That is why when others try to persuade or change us, we become defensive and resistant. To give in challenges our need to feel autonomous. That is why to get people to move from their defensive positions, you must always make it seem like what they are doing is of their own free will. Creating a feeling of mutual warmth helps soften people's resistance and makes them want to help. Never attack people for their beliefs or make them feel insecure about their intelligence or goodness. That will only strengthen their defensiveness and make your task impossible. Make them feel that by doing what you want, they are being noble and altruistic. The ultimate lure. Learn to tame your own stubborn nature and free your mind from its defensive and closed positions, unleashing your creative powers. The Influence Game. In December 1948, Senator Tom Connally of Texas received a visit from the newly elected second senator of the state, Lyndon Baines Johnson, 1908 to 1973. Johnson had previously served as a Democratic congressman in the House of Representatives for 12 years, and had earned a reputation as a politician with high ambitions who was quite impatient to realize them. He could be brash, opinionated, and even a bit pushy. Connally knew all of this, but he was willing to judge Johnson for himself. He studied the young man closely. Connally was 31 years older. He had met him before and thought him rather astute. But after exchanging a few pleasantries, Johnson revealed his true motives. He was hoping to get a seat on one of the three most prestigious committees in the Senate, Appropriations, Finance, or Foreign Relations. Connally served on two of them as a senior member. Johnson seemed to suggest that as a fellow Texan, Connally could help him get what he wanted. Connally felt that Johnson clearly did not understand how the senatorial system worked, and he decided to put him in his place, right then and there. Acting as if he were doing Johnson a great favor, he offered to help him get a seat on the Agriculture Committee. Knowing full well Johnson would find this insulting, it was among the least coveted of all committees. Thrusting the knife in deeper, Connally said that he had followed Johnson's senatorial campaign and had heard him exclaim numerous times that he was a friend of the farmer. Here was his chance to prove it. The Agriculture Committee would be a perfect fit. Johnson could not hide his displeasure and squirmed uncomfortably in his chair. "And then, Lyndon," Connally concluded, "after you've been in the Senate for a while, then you get on the Foreign Relations or Finance Committee and render a real public service." And by "for a while," Connally meant a good 12 to 20 years, the usual time it took for any senator to amass enough influence. It was called seniority, and that was how the game was played. It had taken Connally himself nearly 20 years to get his plum committee positions. Over the next few weeks, word quickly spread among senators that Johnson was someone to keep an eye on, a potential hothead. And so it was a pleasant surprise when many of them saw and met him for the first time after he was officially inaugurated. He was not at all what they had expected. He was the picture of politeness and very deferential. He would often come to visit them in their offices. He would announce himself to the secretary in the outer office, then patiently wait there until called in, sometimes for an hour. He didn't seem bothered by this. He busied himself by reading or taking notes. Once inside, he'd ask the senator about his wife and family or his favorite sports team. He had clearly done his homework on the senator in question. He could be quite self-deprecating. He'd often first introduce himself as Landslide Lyndon, everyone knowing he had won his Senate seat by the slimmest of margins. Mostly, however, he came to talk business and get advice. He'd ask a question or two about some bill or bit of senatorial procedure and would listen with a focus that was striking and charming, almost like a child. His large brown eyes would stay fixed on the senator in question, and with his chin resting on his hand, he would occasionally nod and every now and then ask another question. The senators could tell he was paying deep attention because invariably, he would act on their advice or repeat their very words to someone else, always crediting the senator who had spoken them. He would leave with a gracious thank you for their time and for the invaluable education they had provided. This was not the spirited hothead they had heard so much about, and the contrast redounded to his credit. The senators saw him most often on the Senate floor, and unlike any other member of the institution, he attended every session and sat almost the whole time at his desk. He took copious notes. He wanted to learn everything about senatorial procedure, a dull affair, but one that seemed to captivate him. He was far, however, from being a dullard. When senators encountered him in the hallway or in the cloakroom, he always had a good joke to tell or some amusing anecdote. He had spent his early years in rural poverty, and although he was well educated, his language had some of the color and biting humor of the Texan farmer and migrant worker. The senators found him amusing. Even Tom Connolly had to admit that he had somehow misread him. Older senators, referred to at the time as old bulls, particularly came to appreciate Lyndon Johnson. Although they held positions of great authority based on their seniority, they often felt insecure about their age, some were in their 80s, and their physical and mental capacities. But here was Johnson, visiting their offices frequently, intent on absorbing their wisdom. One older Democratic senator in particular took to Johnson, Richard Russell of Georgia. He was only 11 years older than Johnson, but he had been serving in the Senate since 1933 and had become one of its most powerful members. They had gotten to know each other because Johnson had requested and received a seat on the Armed Services Committee, on which Russell was second in seniority. Russell crossed paths with Johnson in the cloakroom, in the corridors, on the Senate floor. He seemed to be everywhere. And although Johnson visited Russell in his office almost every day, Russell came to enjoy his presence. Like Russell, Johnson was mostly all business and full of questions on arcane Senate procedures. He began to call Russell the old master, and he would often say, "Well, that's a lesson from the old master. I'll remember that." Russell was one of the few senators who had remained a bachelor. He never admitted he was lonely, but he spent almost all of his time at his Senate office, even on Sundays. As Johnson would often be in Russell's office discussing some matter until the evening, he would sometimes invite Russell over for dinner at his house, telling him that his wife, Lady Bird, was an excellent cook, particularly good with Southern dishes. The first few times, Russell politely refused, but finally he relented, and he soon became a weekly regular at the Johnson house. Lady Bird was charming, and he quickly took to her. Slowly, the relationship between Russell and Johnson deepened. Russell was a baseball fanatic, and to his delight, Johnson confessed a weakness for the sport as well. Now they would go together to night games of the Washington Senators. A day would not pass in which they did not see each other, as the two of them would often be the only senators in their offices working on the weekends. They seemed to have so many interests in common, including the Civil War, and they thought alike on so many issues dear to Southern Democrats, such as their opposition to a civil rights bill. Soon, Russell could be heard touting the junior senator as a can-do young man with a capacity equal to his own for hard work. Johnson was the only junior senator over his long career whom he referred to as a disciple. But the friendship went deeper than that. After attending a hunting party that Johnson had organized in Texas, Russell wrote to him, "Ever since I reached home, I have been wondering if I would wake up and find that I had just been dreaming that I had made a trip to Texas. Everything was so perfect that it is difficult to realize that it could happen in real life." In 1950, the Korean War broke out, and there was pressure on the Armed Services Committee to form a subcommittee to investigate the military's preparedness for the war. Such a subcommittee had been formed during World War II and chaired by Harry Truman, and it was through that chairmanship that Truman had become famous and risen to power. The current chairman of the Armed Services Committee was Senator Millard Tidings of Maryland. Tidings would naturally assume the chairmanship of the subcommittee since it would be a great platform for publicity. Johnson approached Tidings with a proposal. Tidings was facing a re-election campaign that year, and Johnson offered to chair the subcommittee only up to the time of the election, allowing Tidings to focus on winning it. Then he would step aside and let Tidings have the position. Tidings, protective of the powers he had accrued, declined Johnson's offer. But then Dick Russell met with him and said something to cause Tidings to change his mind. Johnson was named the chairman, a stunning coup for a senator who had been on the job for only a year and a half. And he would hold on to the job for quite a while, as Tidings lost his re-election bid. As chairman, Johnson was suddenly receiving national public exposure, and journalists covering the Senate discovered that he was a master at handling the press. He carefully guarded the findings of the subcommittee, allowing no leaks to journalists. He surrounded its work with tremendous mystery and drama, giving the impression that the committee was uncovering some real dirt on the military. He doled out information and reports to a select group of powerful journalists who had written articles that he had approved of. The other journalists had to fight for any news crumbs he deigned to offer. The junior senator began to fascinate the press corps. He was tough, yet sympathetic to the journalist's job. And most important, he knew how to give them a good story. Soon some of them were writing about him as a zealous patriot, a future political force to be reckoned with. Now Russell could properly defend his elevation of Johnson. The senator from Texas had done a great job, and had finally gotten the Senate some positive publicity. In May and June of 1951, Johnson and Russell worked closely together on the recall of General MacArthur from Korea. Now Russell had a first-hand view of Johnson's staff, and he was astounded at how efficient it was, larger and better organized than his own. It made Russell feel out of step with the times. But Johnson, as if sensing his thoughts, began to help Russell build his own modern staff. He gave him complete access to the legal and public relations teams he had developed, showing Russell how helpful they could be. As Johnson worked with him on this, the bond between them grew even tighter. One day Russell told a reporter, "That Lyndon Johnson could be president, and would make a good one." The reporter was flabbergasted. It was so unlike Russell to ever pay such a compliment. One spring day in 1951, Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota was waiting to catch the subway to the Capitol when Lyndon Johnson suddenly approached him and suggested they ride together and talk. Such words were like music to Humphrey. He almost couldn't believe Johnson was sincere in the offer. Humphrey had joined the Senate at the same time as Johnson, and he had been considered the bigger star, a charismatic liberal who could be president one day. Humphrey, however, had a problem that had completely impeded his rise to the top. He believed so stridently in liberal causes that he had alienated almost everyone else. In his first speech to the Senate, Humphrey criticized the institution for its slow pace of change and its cozy atmosphere. Soon he was paid back in kind, relegated to the worst committees. The bills he introduced went nowhere. When he would walk into the Senate cloakroom, he would be shunned by almost everyone. As this ostracism got worse, Humphrey felt increasingly depressed and despondent. Sometimes driving home from work, he would pull over and cry. His career had taken a very wrong turn. In the subway car together, Johnson praised him effusively. "Hubert," he told him, "you have no idea what a wonderful experience it is for me to ride to the Senate chamber with you. There are so many ways I envy you. You are articulate. You have such a broad range of knowledge." Feeling relieved to hear this, Humphrey was then surprised by the vehemence of Johnson's criticisms that followed. "But God damn it, Hubert, you're spending so much time making speeches that there is no time left to get anything done." Humphrey needed to be more pragmatic, fit in better. When they finally parted, Johnson invited Humphrey to stop by his office one day for drinks. Humphrey soon became a regular visitor, and this Southern senator, quite loathed by Northern liberals as the darling of the conservative Russell, enthralled him. First, Johnson was immensely entertaining. Everything he said was accompanied by some folksy anecdote, often of a bawdy nature, but always teaching some wicked lesson. Sitting in his office, the drinks being lavishly poured, he would instigate bouts of laughter that would reverberate through the corridors. It was hard to resist a man who could put you in a good mood. He had incredible presence. As Humphrey later wrote, "He'd come on just like a tidal wave, sweeping all over the place. He went through walls. He'd come through a door and he'd take the whole room over." Second, he had such invaluable information to share. He taught Humphrey all of the intricacies of Senate procedure and the knowledge he had accrued about the psychological weaknesses of various senators through close observation. He had become the greatest vote counter in the history of the Senate, able to predict the results of almost any Senate vote with astounding accuracy. He shared with Humphrey his vote counting method. Finally, he taught Humphrey the power he could have by compromising, by being more pragmatic and less idealistic. He would share with him stories about FDR, Humphrey's hero. When Johnson was in the House of Representatives, he had become close friends with the president. FDR, according to Johnson, was a consummate politician who knew how to get things done by retreating tactically and even compromising. The subtext here was that Johnson was really a closet liberal who also idolized FDR and who wanted just as much as Humphrey to pass a civil rights bill. They were both on the same side, fighting for the same noble causes. Working with Johnson, there was no limit to how high Humphrey could rise within the Senate and beyond. As Johnson had correctly guessed, Humphrey had presidential ambitions. Johnson himself could never become president, or so he said to Humphrey, because the nation was not ready for a president from the South. But he could help Humphrey get there. Together, they would make an unbeatable team. What sealed the deal for Humphrey, however, was how Johnson proceeded to make his life easier within the Senate. Johnson talked to his fellow Southern Democrats about Humphrey's intelligence and humor, how they had misread him as a man. Having softened them up in this way, Johnson then reintroduced Humphrey to these senators, who found him charming. Most important of all, he got Russell to change his mind, and Russell could move mountains. Now that he was sharing drinks with the more powerful senators, Humphrey's loneliness faded away. He felt compelled to return the favor and to get many northern liberals to change their minds about Johnson, whose influence was now beginning to spread like an invisible gas. In 1952, the Republicans swept into power with the election of Dwight D. Eisenhower as president, taking in the process control of the Senate and the House. One of the casualties in the election was Ernest McFarland of Arizona, the former Democratic leader in the Senate. Now that the leadership position was vacant, the scrambling for his replacement began. Johnson suggested that Russell himself take the position, but Russell declined. He could have more power operating behind the scenes. Instead, he told Johnson he should be the next leader, and Russell could make it happen. Johnson, acting surprised, said he would consider it, but only if Russell would remain the old master and advise Johnson every step of the way. He did not have to say another word. Within weeks, Russell had essentially helped secure him the position, and it was a remarkable coup. At the age of 44, Johnson was by far the youngest leader in the history of either party. Several weeks into his new position, Johnson came to Russell with a most unusual request. Positions on key committees had been based for decades on seniority, but what this meant was that the committee chairmen were often not up to the job. Men in their 70s and 80s had ideas that were rooted in the past. They did not have the stomach for a big fight. Now, with the Republicans in full control, they were planning on rolling back some of FDR's greatest achievements with the New Deal and in foreign policy. It was going to be a rough 2 years until midterm elections. Johnson wanted the power as the leader of the Senate Democrats to alter the committee landscape. He was not advocating anything radical. He would shift here and there a few committees and chairmanships, bringing in some fresh blood, such as the newly elected Senator John Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey, whom he wanted to get on the Foreign Relations Committee. These younger men would give a fresh public face to the party and bring some energy in combating the Republicans. Russell could see the wisdom in this, and he gave Johnson his tacit approval, but he also warned him, "You're dealing with the most sensitive thing in the Senate. You're playing with dynamite." Johnson approached other older senators. Some were easy to convince, such as Senator Robert Byrd, who had a great fondness for the new leader. Liberals came on board with these changes, thanks to the work of Humphrey, who now had tremendous power as the liaison between Johnson and the Northerners. Others were much more recalcitrant. Johnson, however, would not give up the fight. With those who continued to resist, he went into a higher gear. He became relentless. He would spend hours in his office behind a closed door, talking to himself, rehearsing his arguments and the counterarguments of these stubborn senators until he was sure he had found the perfect approach. To some, he argued pure pragmatism, the need to defeat the Republicans at all costs. With others, he reached back to the glory years of FDR. To Southern senators, he made it clear that making the party more powerful and unified would make Johnson's job easier, and that as a fellow Southerner, he would be their ultimate ally in further fights. He served them endless drinks in his office, pulled out the full arsenal of his wit and charm. He would telephone them at all hours. If the senator continued resisting, he would call again later in the evening. He never argued with vehemence or tried to force the issue. He saw their side. He offered numerous quid pro quos. Eventually, as one senator after another relented, he got the last holdouts to cave in. Somehow, Johnson was now someone to fear. If they did not give in and remained one of the few holdouts, clearly he could make their lives miserable over the next few years. When it finally became public, the Republicans and the press were astounded at what Lyndon Johnson had accomplished. In a matter of weeks since assuming the leadership position, he had gained unprecedented powers. He, not the seniority system, controlled committee appointments. He was now the undisputed master of the Senate, and the byword among his colleagues was, "Let Lyndon do it." Drawn into his sphere of influence was the most unlikely cast of characters, from Dick Russell to Hubert Humphrey. But the most astonished person of all must have been Senator Tom Connally himself. In 4 short years, Johnson had not only risen to the top, but had gained control of the Senate Democrats through a slow and steady campaign of accumulating influence, far surpassing the power Connally had accrued in over 20 years of service. Interpretation. From the beginning of his political career, Johnson had a single ambition, to one day become President of the United States. To get there, he needed a relatively swift rise to prominence. The younger he reached leadership positions, the more time he would have to spread his name and gain leverage within the Democratic Party. Elected to the House of Representatives at the age of 28, he seemed on track to get what he wanted. But in the House, his career got bogged down. The place was so big and complex, and he was not good at dealing with large groups. He was not an exciting public speaker. He was much more charming in one-on-one situations. He became frustrated and restless. Finally reaching the Senate at the age of 40, he brought with him his impatience, as evidenced by his meeting with Connally. But shortly before his inauguration, he toured the floor of the Senate and had an epiphany. The place was much smaller. It was more like a cozy club for gentlemen. Here he could work one-on-one and slowly gain power by accumulating influence. To accomplish this, however, he had to transform himself. He was naturally aggressive. He would have to rein this in, slow down, and step back. He would have to stop talking so much and getting into heated arguments. Let other people do the talking. Let them feel like the star of the show. Stop thinking of himself. Instead, focus completely on his fellow senators as they talked and talked. Assume the inoffensive front of the junior senator learning the ropes, the serious and somewhat dull student of procedure and legislation. Behind this front, he could observe people without seeming ambitious or aggressive. In this way, he could slowly gain knowledge of the inner workings of the Senate, vote counting, how bills were actually passed, and insights into the various senators, their deepest insecurities and weaknesses. At some point, his deep understanding of the institution would translate into a commodity he could exchange for influence and favors. After several months of this campaign, he was able to alter the reputation he had had in the House. He no longer seemed a threat, and with the senator's defenses down, Johnson could escalate his campaign. He turned his attention to winning over key allies. As he had always believed, having one key ally at or near the top of the hierarchy could move mountains. Early on, he spotted Senator Russell as the perfect target. Lonely, a believer in a cause without any real disciples, and very powerful. Johnson genuinely liked Russell, and he was always in search of father figures, but his attention and approach were highly strategic. He made sure he got appointed to the Armed Services Committee, where he would have the most access to Russell. Their constant encounters in the hallway or the cloakroom were rarely accidental. Without making